Well, so Jack, this is maybe an odd way to begin, but the blurbs on the back of your book, I mean, there's Paul Begala says Jack Abramoff is scum. Congresswoman Deborah Price says he's a creep and we hate him. Senator Conrad Burns says he wishes you'd never been born. I mean, wow.
Yeah, those are the only positive comments I could find to put on the book. No, I'm kidding. The you know, the publisher, as all publishers want, he wanted me to get some opprobriums that I could put on the book, but all I had was opprobrium from the past. So I had written the manuscript and I hadn't shared it with anyone. And so I thought it would be more interesting, frankly, for people picking the book up in the bookstore to see those comments and wonder, you know, why would these people say this stuff about this guy?
Well, it's definitely attention grabbing, which, as you say, is part of the point. But do you think you deserve that level of vitriol?
No, I didn't. What happened was that, you know, I sat quiet while this all unfolded. I didn't either defend myself or present that I'm a human being, even to anyone. I just sort of sat quiet. I didn't aid my cause by coming out of court one day in a hat, which became sort of the ubiquitous picture of me everywhere.
That black fedora?
Yeah, it was a rain hat, basically.
Makes you look like a gangster, though.
Point. I guess if I was in the 1940s, I don't think gangsters guess, you know, dressed like this these days. The media, as I exited the courtroom, the media started screaming, "Hey, Boris Badenov, hey, you know, mafiosi," that kind of thing. And, you know, I didn't at first know what they were talking about. I tried to get to the court early that morning so I could avoid the paparazzi. And it was raining, and I put a raincoat and hat on as I walked out the door. It was still dark. It was a January morning in Washington. And, unfortunately for me, I wasn't thinking about what I was wearing. I was thinking about the fact that I was pleading to crimes in the courtroom. And when I came out, that kind of became my image. And so, you know, I didn't really get a chance to show people that I'm a human being, too. And yeah, I did things that were wrong, but maybe I didn't do everything I was accused of doing. I was accused of doing, you know, some things that even I couldn't have pulled off. Some of the folks in Louisiana accused me of being responsible for Hurricane Katrina, for goodness sakes. And, you know, my response was that I was a good lobbyist, but I wasn't that good, you know, that I could pull that off. But, you know, it just got out of hand. And those kind of comments that are on the back of the book, I think, are representative of how people, you know, started to feel about me. And while I did do wrong and I did participate in a system that I think aggravates and upsets people, I was never the devil that they thought I was. And unfortunately for me, I was never the saint that I thought I was. So it was somewhere in between.
So, I mean, you were tried and convicted of bribing public officials, basically corrupting the political process. You served your time in jail. I'm curious how you look back on things now. I mean, you said that you did do wrong. Really? Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I came to a different view of myself and of the system I participated in over time. This has been over 8 years that this has been going on. When it first started, frankly, there were articles in the Washington Post, and the discussion at my law firm was, do we post these articles on the firm website? They were really nothing out of the ordinary at first. As things
when the first articles, like the Washington Post articles accusing you of influence peddling and unfair influence, you thought of putting those on your website?
Yeah. It to a lobbyist in that system, basically the article said that I had a lot of influence, I charged a lot of money, and I was very powerful. And, you know, that's how in those days, that's the prism through which I would read those articles. And frankly, the people around me did. And it's kind of ironic, almost kind of ghetto or gallows humor, that we actually had a discussion on email the next morning. Should we post this article on the website? That's just how out of it we were, how
did
deep
you?
In the forest we were. No, we didn't, because we didn't like the headline and we didn't like the picture. I mean, think about how superficial that analysis is, but tragically, that's where we were holding.
But that's such an interesting place that, you know, so you're at this place where the first headlines are coming out and you don't feel guilt. You don't think, oh my gosh, they found me, I'm breaking all the laws. Obviously, I mean, there's some part of you that thinks I'm just doing what everybody else does.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, as I was going to say, my first reaction beyond should we put this on the website was, what's the big deal? This will blow over. It's Washington. Things blow over. Everybody's got ADD, you know, in Washington. So there'll be something else that come along. And after a week or two, this will be out of the headlines and nobody will care. That was my first real reaction. And that obviously didn't happen as I started getting pummeled day in and day out. And hearings were being called in the House and the Senate and just all sorts of things were going on. And my next reaction was, what in the world is this? You know, well, why me? You know, what have I done that's any different than anybody else? I'm just playing the system as I learned it. And that was my reaction for a little bit longer until I finally said, you know what, I better take an honest look at this and at myself and what I did. And I started to go through with my attorneys the emails that I wrote. And I came to the realization, number one, that yes, indeed, I went over the line. I broke the law. It wasn't something, frankly, I thought much about. I didn't think these laws were serious, frankly, when I was a lobbyist. I thought they were only laws on congressmen, not on lobbyists. In fact, frankly, many of them were. And so I thought, you know, what's going on here? Why am I getting picked on? Until finally I started looking at it. And as I started to see that, in fact, I was wrong. I broke the law. I did things that I'm ashamed of, that I shouldn't have been doing. I frankly shouldn't have been in the system. What was I doing there? I started over time, and I'm talking months and months, and it turned into years and years of rethinking everything. And by the time, even before I got to prison, I had frankly come to the epiphany that I was not only guilty, I was wrong. I was wrong in terms of what was illegal, but worse, because 99% of what I did was frankly legal. I was wrong in what was legal. And I entered prison knowing that, frankly, I unfortunately probably belonged there.
You said you were wrong also. You thought you were wrong in terms of not just what was legal, but what was moral?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's certainly not only the standard of what actually breaks the law. And, you know, there's the standard of what's right and wrong. What are you embarrassed about if you do it? Even if it's legal, there are many things that are legal that we don't do. And I think that business, the lobbying business, the situation on Capitol Hill, is replete with all sorts of things that are absolutely legal, but are repugnant and reprehensible. One can be completely contemptuous within the bounds of the law. And I was, although I somehow went over the bounds of the law.
But so like what? I mean, what specifically are you embarrassed mm-hmm. about or feel ashamed of?
Well, I, even though it's not defined as bribery, and by the way, I didn't get a trial or convicted. I pled. I came to the agreement that I was wrong, and I cooperated and wanted to get through it in an honest way. I didn't want to fight and create a spectacle. I wanted to deal with it honestly. So, but I didn't legally. I didn't quote unquote bribe anyone. But of course, I bribe people. It goes on every day. Anytime a lobbyist or a lobbyist's client conveys a financial interest to a public servant with the interest of that public servant doing something on their behalf, it's a bribe. And so I was deeply enmeshed in a system of legalized bribery that's shameful and that's wrong and that I'm working at this point in my life to do everything I can to change.
Will you play out for, you know, those of us who don't work on Capitol Hill, I mean, how does this work? You know, let's say I want a vote passed by a representative. What do you do?
Well, usually you hire a lobbyist because most people can't come directly, spend the time to develop the relationships necessary to gain the access to make their points. Lobbying is all about access. Can you get in the room with the decision maker? Part two of lobbying, of course, is being persuasive. But if you're not in the room, if you're not talking to the person making the decision, I don't care how persuasive you are, it doesn't matter. So step one in lobbying, get in the room, get the access. And that, unfortunately, not everyone, but for the most part, those who have tremendous access, garner it because of giving money, raising money politically for congressmen, taking them on trips, going with them on trips, playing golf, sharing meals, giving them sports tickets, etc. Basically all the components of bribery. And that's how that is done. So if you have something you want changed, you're going to hire a lobbyist who has the best access on Capitol Hill to the congressman who is important to you. And that individual, you're going to rely on them to make sure that they have the kind of access, frankly, that you and everyone else isn't going to normally get. It's only going to be gotten because they are important financially to that member of Congress and their staff. And that access is the corrupting part of lobbying, that when using money to gain that access, and that's indeed what is bribery.
You know, the way you describe it, like golf games, tickets to sports events, frankly, it doesn't sound all that, like, it just doesn't sound like that big a deal. But I think what we're missing is the epic scale on which you did this. I mean, you paid millions of dollars in, I don't know, for sports tickets alone, right?
Yeah, I just want to say, though, that it is a big deal, and it's not necessarily about only the scale. I was operating on a scale that was, frankly, ridiculous, but that's a personality defect I have. I had a mantra of, if it's worth doing, it's worth overdoing. And so instead of buying four tickets, let's just say, to the Redskins game, I had 72 tickets. Instead of having just some seats at the Wizards basketball game, I had 40 tickets, you know, that kind of thing. I overdid it. I didn't take people on meals. I owned restaurants. I didn't take them playing golf. I put them on an airplane and took them to St. Andrews, the old course, to play golf. So I overdid it. But the issue isn't the Jack Abramoffs of the world. Jack Abramoff got punished for overdoing it and for going over the line as I did. The issue is that every gratuity, even things that don't sound like a big deal, are helping to corrode the system. The fact that it doesn't sound like a big deal, by the way, is indeed what people on Capitol Hill believe. You will hear constantly a member of Congress say, no one's going to buy my vote for a $2,000 contribution or a meal or a ticket to the Redskins or something like that. The truth is, though, the relationship is created where the public servant has gratitude, if they're a decent person, has gratitude to those who give them anything. And that is, while in normal life we want people to have gratitude to each other, that's how society operates. There's that very effective commercial, I don't know if you saw, where somebody sees somebody helping somebody who is challenged, physically challenged, and then they go do something good for somebody, and then they do something good for something, and it's just a cascading bunch of good deeds. That's what we want in society. The problem is when it's a public servant. That ends there. They cannot be affected by gifts and things like that because they just shouldn't be able to get them.
That gratitude you referred to, you used to talk about owning people. Is that what you mean? They feel indebted to
you? Yeah, but it doesn't even have... what I would talk about is having so much influence in an office that you literally owned it. In the context of my book, what I talked about it was where I noticed that when I offered a job to, say, a chief of staff, and they were going to come join me in a year at the lobbying firm. And I should just note that virtually everybody I dealt with up there wanted to work for me, wanted to move over to K Street and become a lobbyist and make much more money.
So you're talking about, like, say, the legislative aide to a senator?
The senator and their legislative aides.
So you'd say to both of them, you know, when you're done here on Capitol Hill, you've got a job with me, just want you to know?
Right. I actually would rarely say it to the legislators because, frankly, I considered them mostly lazy, you know, and used to too much comfort and pampering. I wanted people on my staff who were used to hard work, and that meant their staff. So whenever I did offer a job, I noticed at that moment, whenever they accepted it, from that moment until the day they came to join me, and it could, again, be a year or more, they were working for me already. And in fact, that's how, as I describe in Capital Punishment in my book, that's how the kind of control that a lobbyist can have over a real vice grip over a congressional office can take place.
How often did you do this? I mean, how many job offers did you make?
Well, I mean, I only made a job offer to somebody I wanted to hire, and I had upwards of 40 lobbyists working for me. So over time, I probably at least a couple dozen times I would make those offers.
And how many... I don't know, when you think about how many offices in Senate and congressional offices, and how many of those did you have staff you thought you owned?
Well, probably 100 offices. We felt that we had serious impact in their offices. And then beyond that, probably a total, I don't know, about 300 offices that we had some impact. And the other offices we either didn't need to get to or we could get to. I mean, a top lobbying firm, people have to understand something. The lobbying firms in Washington, the top tier, and we were at the top tier, their full-time job is obtaining access, working the access, maintaining the access, and doing everything they can to make sure they can get in and get offices to help them and do what they want. And they do it in large part through raising money. I raise millions of dollars a year through my clients and others and got it to members of Congress who were helpful to my clients on both sides. 60% roughly got Republicans, 40% Democrats. And I had Republicans and Democrats who worked for me. And people have to realize that this is what goes on. This is their stock and trade. And so they spend their full time doing it.
So here's the thing that I never understand. You know, I've read a lot of stories about you, and everybody's very focused on, I mean, you are the big bad guy. You are the poster boy for, you know, corrupt Washington, D.C. But all those guys you quote-unquote owned, all those senators and congressional people and their staffs, they took what you offered. I mean, you didn't hold a gun to their heads or anything, right?
Right, no.
So,
I didn't.
So I don't understand. I mean, who's corrupt? To me, there's, you know, you may have been the devil incarnate offering temptation, but they took it.
Yeah, I mean, clearly it takes two to tango in Washington, at least two to tango, and people are on both sides of that equation. But again, don't forget, 99% of the things I did were legal. All right, so people ask, why aren't there a bunch of people in jail? Because it's not illegal. That's the problem. It is legal. This needs to change, and I'm working right now very hard with some of the reform groups, particularly United Republic, to change this and to change the rules. Because these rules, by the way, are drawn by the very people who intend later to go become lobbyists. So obviously they're not going to draw them too tightly. And so and they benefit from them while they sit in there. So the rules need to be changed. People didn't go down with me because there weren't a lot of people who had to go, who felt a need to go over the line. Frankly, I was stupid. I didn't need to go over the line either, but I did. And had I not, I might still be up there doing it, tragically. So in a certain respect, for me, it was beneficial. I mean, this was a horrific experience. Please let me not say anything else. But in a certain way, I thank God that that I was taken out of there.
Did people ever turn you down? I mean, are there people on Capitol Hill who are not corruptible?
Yeah, there are, but you have to understand how sophisticated the process is. We never asked a favor that we knew we weren't going to get. We didn't just go blindly into offices. We knew everything about them. We knew what they believed. We knew what was important to them. 99% of the time, we'd ask congressmen to do things they already support and already agree to do. Basically, lobbying for us was moving things up on their agenda. So something that maybe was in the bottom 100 of issues they cared about became in the top 10 because we became important to them. And so when you're operating like that, and that is, in fact, how most effective lobbyists operate, you're not going to get a lot of turndowns because you know what you're asking. You know that you're going to get what you ask. You're just positioning yourself as a lobbyist into their office as a friend who's not asking anything. Most of the lobbyists at the beginning will just help them, just raise money for them, just be there for them, just explain the ropes to them if they're new, help them hire their staff. You can't imagine how intertwined many lobbyists are with these offices. And then when the time comes later that the lobbyist has a client and they need a favor and they say, Congressman, gee, would you mind just meeting with my client? He's coming to town and listen to our issue. In fact, it's something you agree with anyway. Would you help us? It becomes much, much more easy for those people to do that.
So what you're describing is a system where, you know, of course, everybody there would agree there's a difference between right and wrong. But in the course of a working day in the political trenches on Capitol Hill, it's just not that clear where the dividing line is.
No, I never thought I was doing anything wrong. I never did. I mean, that's a tragedy, by the way, that I would go through this whole process. And I thought I had, you know, clients who frankly, I agreed with their issues. I never took a client. I wouldn't take a client if I didn't agree with their issues. They were in life and death fights. We would win these fights to them, saving them hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. They would pay us tens of millions of dollars. I would give away personally about 80% of the money I made to charity and things that I wanted to support, community efforts. So I didn't think I was doing anything wrong. I thought it was just more effectively fighting within a political system on behalf of my clients against bullies who wanted to beat them up. And so I never looked up and said, wait a minute, all of this is wrong. all of this is wrong. I may have convinced myself that it's not, but it is. And with me, you know, in my faith and the things that I believe, unfortunately, which I didn't apply here for some idiotic reason, it's worse to think you're doing the right thing if you're on the wrong track than to know you're doing something wrong. Because if you know you're doing something wrong, you have a chance to repent and stop. But I would never have stopped if I didn't have a 2x4 to my head in the form of what happened to me. And that, to me, in a certain respect, again, as I say, I'm at some level grateful for that.
How could you not have known some of it was wrong? I mean, you're making $20 million a year. And, I mean, you were also charging your clients unfair and exorbitant rates for some of it. How can you not have thought something was wrong?
First of all, let me correct you here. I have, again, this, some of the accusations about me are just not accurate. I charge my clients roughly $80 million, north of about $80 million in total, this being my firm's. We delivered about $6.8 billion to them in returns. So our clients felt that we were absolutely not only not ripping them off, we were doing tremendous things for them. So I didn't do everything right by them, by the way. I didn't, and what I pled guilty to was that I didn't inform my clients that I was sharing in the profit of companies that I recommended to them to work on some of their outside DC efforts that I worked on as well, by the way, but I didn't inform them of that. That's what I pled guilty to. But in the context, yes, I should have, frankly, that was wrong. And that's something I should have woke up to. I didn't. All I can say is I'm terribly sorry I've been punished for it. I wouldn't do it again. I'm very careful to try to not do things that are wrong at this point. But I can explain it correctly, that in the atmosphere I was in, I didn't at all think I was ripping off my clients. I thought my clients were getting immense value. And they thought, by the way, they were getting immense value for the services I performed for them. And I was, again, taking the money I made, which was a lot of money, and giving it away. So those all, unfortunately, contributed to my not sitting down and focusing. I had convinced myself that I was doing the right thing. I now look back and say, oh, my God, what the heck was wrong with me doing all this? And it was wrong and shameful, and I regret it. But I'm trying to explain what the mindset was while I was in it. It wasn't like I was sitting there giggling and, oh, gee, you know, I'm really going to get you guys and things like that. I was a very passionate, aggressive killer in the lobbying business. And that was, frankly, at the end of it, inconsistent with who I should have been. But that's who I was. And unfortunately, it was not easy for me any more, by the way, than it's easy for any of the others who are currently doing it, to sit back and say, you know what, we shouldn't be doing this. This is wrong. This system is destroying the country. I didn't do that for a minute. I really regret it. I wish, by the way, I could say to you, I did. I wish I didn't have to say the shameful thing that it took my head getting cut off for me to realize I was wrong. You know, that says something very bad about me, I guess. And, you know, it's something I'm trying to work on.
So I'm curious about the personal part of coming back from something like that, not so much in the, you know, the public sense, but I guess I'm thinking about personal redemption. You know, how do you forgive yourself? Do you not? Do you try to atone? I mean, what is this process like?
Well, I certainly try to atone. I've been trying to atone every day since I came to the epiphany that I was wrong. And, you know, the first step in atonement is, first of all, realizing that you've done something wrong. Because many people, including, by the way, many of the men I spent time in prison with, didn't ever come to that first step, didn't even realize that they did something wrong and admit it to themselves, at least, if not to everybody else, at least to themselves. The second step being having regret. That, yeah, I did something wrong, and I regret it. That's a very important second step. The third step is gets more difficult, you know, trying to somehow repair the wrong you did. With me, it's very difficult to do that because, you know, how do I repair it? Now, part of it I'm trying to do now. I'm trying to speak out and help change the system, at least, that I was involved in. I'm trying quietly to help repair those that were involved in my situation, you know, where appropriate I can, you know, and legal, I can step in and help. I'm paying restitution financially, which in an immense amount to those who were wronged. And
how much,
finally,
that's in the millions, am I right?
$44 million, yes. And it's a lot. And I mean, I'm certainly going to be paying that for the rest of my life. But even if I weren't paying it for the rest of my life, there won't be a day in my life, and there hasn't been a day in my life, when I don't think about these things, think about what was it about me that enabled me to do all, you know, these things, to get into this world, and fight those impulses that are deeply embedded. You know, change a human personality characteristic is one of the most difficult things in the world, and it requires constant vigilance, and I'm trying. And then finally, in terms of finding the final step of repentance and atonement, if you get put back into the same situation, how do you behave? I don't expect to be put back into the same situation. I'm not going to become a lobbyist again, and I don't expect anybody would want me to be a lobbyist again, certainly not those folks on Capitol Hill. So I don't know what will be the test that eventually I'll get where I'll be able to resist going down the path that I went down, but I hope it comes, and I hope I pass that test.
You're a religious person, an Orthodox Jew. Does those concepts we were talking about, atonement and repair, do those come for you partly out of your religious faith?
Yeah, I mean, the steps that I delineated come completely out of our out of Maimonides, who was one of our great commentators from the 1200s. And the steps, repentance and atonement, is a vital part of our faith, to be able to renew and to somehow bring yourself back, or somehow at least go in the right direction. You know, in our faith, it's not necessarily where you're holding, it's what's your next step, where are you going? And I'm not holding in a great place. I put myself into a bad place. I'm in a better place than I was a few years ago when I sat in prison. But the question is, what am I doing today? What am I doing tomorrow? And I'm trying to use the time I have here to do what's right and to fight some of the things that, that frankly, I took advantage of when I was in there.
So if you were to expand that concept of atonement and repair and apply it to the entire corrupt political system that you were part of, and if you were to say, you know, it's not just me who has to atone and repair, it's the whole system. As you said, it takes two to tango. What would that look like? What would you prescribe to our politicians?
Well, what I did was, when I got to prison, I had already come to the, as I mentioned, the epiphany that I was wrong, the system's wrong. My plan was to do my prison time and then just go away. I hope people forgot my unique last name and just carve out a new life for my family and me and just go away. As I was in prison, I started rethinking that. And I decided that, you know what, I was behind too many closed doors and saw too many things and know too many of the tricks of the trade to do that. I owe it to the American people. I owe it to myself to get out there and to start talking about what really goes on. Now, I started that as kind of a philosophical approach. Finally, and I was there for years, after a few years, as I walked the walking track in prison, I started to say to myself, you know what, if I were still a lobbyist, what steps, what reforms would I fight? What would I go out of my way to stop if I saw them coming down the pike? What would I do? And because, frankly, the reforms that they put through are silly. They deal with the margins. They don't deal with the core issues. So I sat and thought through, or I walked and thought through steps, and I wrote them in my book. And basically, they're in many, many levels and many ways, but they come down to four that I'm focused on right now, and they are as follows. Number one, to remove the bribery from the system. And what does that mean? Every lobbyist, and by the way, just as a footnote here, the definition of lobbyist is insufficient. When Newt Gingrich can go up to the Hill and lobby, meet with members of Congress, but by not spending 20% of his time on it, escape registration as a lobbyist, and he's not alone. Tom Daschle and many others on both sides of the aisle have done this, where they go up as strategic advisors. That is a problem. So part of the reforms that we're working on are to tighten severely the definition of a lobbyist. If you go lobby, you're a lobbyist, whether you do it 20% of the time, once, or all the time. If you're preparing a lobbying effort, you're a lobbyist and you need to be registered. So the reform I have financially would be that if you are this new defined lobbyist, or you're a client of this lobbyist, meaning you're somebody getting something special from the federal government for you, for your company, for your labor union, for whoever, a special interest, you are barred from giving any money politically to a member of Congress.
Or to
a PAC? You are barred to anything federally. You may not participate in federal elections financially. You've made a choice to either lobby or to get something from the government. And as a consequence, like in other areas of our life where we make choices, you've given up a right, which is a free speech right. We see that, by the way, if you get security clearance, you have to give up a free speech right. So the legislation that I'm working on with United Republic would hopefully lead us to the point where anybody who is a special interest or a lobbyist, as properly defined, would be taken out of the financial system, not permitted to give a contribution, not permitted to provide a gratuity, not permitted to provide a cup of coffee. So that's step one, no more bribery. Step two in the system would be the closing of the revolving door. If I had my druthers and it weren't unconstitutional, I would say that if you work on Capitol Hill as a lobbyist, I'm sorry, as a senator or a congressman or a staffer, you may never enter the influence industry. You may never be somebody in the new definition of what a lobbyist is. However, we can't have things like that according to our law, lifetime bans. So what we're going to propose is a 10-year ban, that if you're up there and you're serving the public, for at least 10 years, you can't cash in on it. And by then, frankly, your interest, your influence has waned.
the way things turn around. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Number three is term limits. As a lobbyist, I was very much against term limits. And one can understand why. Once you own a congressional office, you don't have to rebuy them in 6 years. You want every congressman to stay there like Strom Thurmond till they're 100 years old and be carted out by the Undertaker. And you just want to maintain those relationships, which is a lot cheaper than creating the relationship. And number four, so I would be in favor of term limits. And number four is something, of course, very intuitive, that there can be no law that applies to all of us and doesn't apply to all of them. If you're in Congress, every law you make immediately and automatically applies to you. And so that we don't wind up with these insider trading debacles and these friends and family stock things where any of us would be put in prison if we did it. Whereas with them, they can blithely go along the way. So those are the four pillars of reform that we're working on right now. And I think that they would have a dramatic impact on the power of money and the probably untilt to a great degree, the very tilted playing field that exists currently.
Well, I wish you a lot of success with it. But I guess I have to say, I came of age in the Nixon years. Frankly, none of what happened to you surprised me all that much. I guess I've always assumed Washington was corrupt. All of Capitol Hill seems like a snake pit to me, full of ambitious people doing everything they can to wield power on behalf of whatever they care about. And I don't see why any of us ever expected it would be any different. I mean, when have centers of power ever been any different? So what makes you think that politics could ever be clean?
Well, I agree with you completely, by the way. The concentration of power is the greatest danger and the greatest threat. Our founders of our country spoke about it, wrote about it at length. De Tocqueville wrote about it at length. Anyone interested in freedom wrote about it at length. But unfortunately, we're sitting now with a federal state that has accumulated immense power, far beyond the designs of the nation at its founding. And so the concentration of power is what will breed corruption. It always will. What I'm talking about with these reforms are things that will help, let's just say, best arrange the chairs on the deck. But until we turn around the ship of state, until we start devolving some of the programs and sending them back to local government, and in some cases getting rid of them so that the federal behemoth is somehow tamed, you're exactly correct. There is no way in the world to overcome human nature. This town, Washington, attracts people who are very smart and very interested in power. Scores of them, millions of them come here over time. And they don't come here because they think that there's nothing to do. There's plenty to do. There aren't 30,000 lobbyists running around because there's nothing to do. The federal government has set itself up in a way that not only has put the country into a $16 trillion debt, but has every decision of importance coming out of this city. That is not what's intended. And that's what empowers the lobbyists. And that's what makes the politics so very frustrating.